Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davis. Artificial intelligence is already changing our politics. It's making it easier to produce deep fakes, and they flood social media with disinformation, and they're manipulating public debate. But could that same technology also help repair a democracy that many Americans believe is no longer working for them? In her new book, Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy, Beth Simon Novick argues that democratic dysfunction is not only a political problem, it is also a design challenge. She says carefully governed AI could help identify election disinformation, give citizens a stronger voice in policymaking, reduce government backlogs, and make public service more responsive. But without public oversight, the technology could instead concentrate power and deepen inequity. Novick is a professor and the director of the Burns Center for Social Change at Northeastern University. She also leads the Governance Lab and Innovate US, and previously advised governments from the Obama White House to 10 Downing Street. And Beth Simon Novick, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, it's when you tell people first off the bat that we could use AI to save democracy, and we can design tools to do that, the first reaction people have is like, AI is bad. It's already been working. So being used, because it's a tool, people are using this tool in order to tear down our democracy. So the first thing is to get people to open up their minds and accept that it is a tool and it depends on who's using it. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. Look, all technologies are dual purpose. You can think about nuclear as something we use to power our electricity grid or as something we use to build a bomb. And, you know, these tools, and AI, by the way, is a whole basket full of tools, some of which are more controversial than others, but especially this latest generation of generative AI tools, things we can use essentially like a better word processor, are really just that. So as you point out, we have to open up our mind and open up sort of our discourse and how we talk about it, because otherwise my concern is if we only talk about the risks, that's the future we're going to achieve. And if we're never talking about what we could do differently, how communities, how you and I could use these tools for really good things, we won't make those investments, we won't make those decisions, and frankly, you know, the risks will overwhelm the benefits.
Well, my concern is that we're only going to let the bad actors use AI in order to warp reality and try to, contaminate a political discourse. And if we don't have the good actors who want to use AI to strengthen democracy, then we've already lost.
You're 100% right. And look, most of the story we hear about, we talk about, especially now in the run-up to the midterms, tends to be this conversation about misinformation and disinformation and deepfakes, right? And it's a real problem. Propaganda and lies have always been a problem, but AI has really accelerated the quantity of disinformation, the quality of the deception, and how fast it can spread. And above all, I think the personalization. So now you're getting deepfakes targeted at you. There isn't a day of the week where I don't get an email from Oprah telling me how much she loves my book. That's very, very convincing when it gives a summary of my books and it's written in my name, and we see the same thing around elections. So we have to be concerned about this. But again, if we're always playing whack-a-mole with the bad stuff, then we're not talking about what are the good things we can do. We're not talking about that a group called MEDON operates across 60 countries around the globe, working with media groups around elections to use AI to actually spot deepfakes and to debunk those deepfakes. The Brennan Center at NYU has been testing the use of chatbots, for example, to provide accurate election information to people so that when you want to know where your polling place is or the rules of your election, But what, again, the laws are, you can actually get accurate information. It's really just important that we talk about both sides of the equation. And we talk about also some of these really mundane details. Like even in Texas, it's probably a lot less talked about that the government itself is rolling out secure access to AI so that government workers have access to secure tools that they can do things like write information in plain language and provide better services to people. So I just want to make sure we're having kind of both sides of that conversation and not only talking about the robot apocalypse.
So AI can be used to help address some of these design challenges that we have with government. People feel like government doesn't understand them, that they don't have a voice, and that they're speaking different languages. How can AI fix that?
Well, I think this issue of our lack of agency, the fact that we live, perhaps we might think about it as democracy in name only. Yes, we go to vote, but that tends to be for most people, you know, that once a year experience of going to the polling place, their only experience with democracy. So the notion of government of, for, and by the people, really, it's a vanishingly small number of people, you know, who have influence over our political system. And I think we feel that acutely as prices go up, as income inequality widens, as the price of gas increases, as life expectancy goes down. I think we feel the loss of control. And AI only, I think the fear of AI really exacerbates that. But let's contrast that with, and again, starts with the will to want to do this, those institutions that are going out and doing things in a different way. So in Bowling Green, Kentucky, they said, we want to think about the future of our community, and we're going to go out and ask people, the citizens, the residents in our community, what we should do differently, what they want from their town. California did something similar after the wildfires with a project called Engaged California. Or when I used to lead AI in New Jersey and we had to determine our AI policy, we went out and we asked workers what their fears were, what their hopes were. Now, we've done polling and roundtables and town halls in the past, but the problem with things like that, especially online, is you've got everybody talking, and that makes it really, really hard for government to listen. What's different with these new examples in New Jersey and Bowling Green and California is that they're using AI under the hood to help summarize and synthesize and make sense of what people are telling them so that when, you know, thousands of people respond to Engage California about the wildfires, they can rapidly turn that into 19 concrete policy proposals and actually move those forward so that what the public contributes leads to real outcomes. And there's examples like this I can give you around the world. It's still pilots. It's still early days. You know, it's not the norm in how things are working. But I'm excited about the fact that in Germany, for example, they started using AI to help them in the city of Hamburg make land use decisions and summarize what communities were telling them about. How do you want to use the park or this, you know, parking lot or this derelict land use site? And then they use AI to summarize it. Now every single land use decision, every single environmental decision is made with the benefit of public input. That to me is the future we want to aim towards, a world in which we have much more voice and much more agency than we do today. And I think if we use the right AI and we use it well, we could accomplish that.
The issue of trust, the people who have developed AI and control AI, these billionaires, they don't seem to have the public's best interest in mind. So people have developed a very skeptical view of what AI can do for them. How do we know that this is going to actually be working in the public's best interest?
It won't be unless we do something differently. You're 100% right. And we've seen this issue play itself out with social media in particular, where, you know, we had this great hope that, you know, the internet and social media would be the town square and foster free speech. And, you know, we should give some credit where credit is due, that lots more people can express themselves on TikTok, on YouTube, on social media. And there's a lot of benefits to this. But we've also seen the downsides in terms of human isolation, risks to mental health. And that comes from corporate overlords who are seeking to maximize their profit, right? They feed us this rage bait, clickbait headlines so that we will stay on the site more and they can feed us more advertising. That is not surprising. And that is, you know, the risk that we are in danger of perpetrating again with AI. So we have to do things differently. You know, in South Korea, they've decided to make a different decision. They have made an investment in saying, we are going to build what is sometimes called public AI. So we know public radio is a great thing. Doesn't undermine the market for private radio. We have lots of other radio stations. We have lots of other media channels. But I think anybody listening here can agree there is a benefit to publicly governed, managed radio and other infrastructure that is accountable to somebody other than just a CEO in Silicon Valley, or even just to some shareholders and advertisers. So that's what Korea has said. We're going to build our own public AI, and we're going to give it away for free to citizens and to government. As we have these debates about data centers, I'm concerned that we are not, for example, doing much more pushback, not just on should we have a data center or should we not, but if we're going to put these things in our backyards, how are we going to benefit? We're talking about what we don't want the companies to take from us. Question is, what are they going to give back to us? And if we're not going to get it from the companies, then we need to do something differently. Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, Estonia, Korea, all these other jurisdictions are going out and saying, we're going to build a public and public alternatives to complement the private market offerings. Again, it's not to replace it, it's to complement it like we have with public radio.
Well, on this public radio station, you can call in with your questions and comments about AI and have a question for Beth Simon-Novick. Her book is Reboot AI and the Race to Save Democracy. How would you use AI to strengthen our voting system, to give greater transparency to our government, also find a way to curate what people really want, all of our voices into a way that is fair and encourages civil dialogue. Well, give us a call. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source returns after a one-minute break.
Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Beth Simon-Novick. Her book is Reboot AI and the Race to Save Democracy. Why is it a race?
I don't think anyone would disagree that our democracy is in trouble. That means many things to many people, but I think right now we're seeing the risks of election subversion, the undermining of our ability to have free, fair, and frequent elections in this country. But again, it's more than that. Democracy is also about our ability to participate, you know, government of, for, and by the people, sort of having a voice in what that means. But it's also, I think, really fundamentally about having institutions, democratic institutions, that know how to deliver for us, that know how to listen and learn and solve problems. Now, the world is awash in really, really complex problems, but I don't think there's anybody out there who thinks government does as good a job as it needs to do at responding to the myriad crises that we're facing. So whether for you democracy is about the ability to participate or how our representatives represent us or free elections or this issue of just government functioning and capacity, you know, the issue that was really central in the whole DOGE debates. Things are just not working as well as they need to. And I think a lot of people feel, and the polling data supports this, they feel that they're, you know, at least for the next generation, that expectations are going backwards. So I think it's an urgent need, both in terms of our democracy and its fragility, but also we have this moment with AI. Before we build these tools and put them in our schools and put them in our governments and put the data centers in our backyard, we have an opportunity to do things differently. And that's why I think it's so urgent we start talking about not just what we don't want to do, what the risks are and how to avoid them, but what we do want to do differently to realize the benefits, to ensure that, for example, you know, we are giving tools to teachers to reduce the drudgery and the paperwork so that they have more time to spend with kids, not less, not replacing the teacher, but again, getting rid of some of that menial paperwork that takes time away from being in the classroom. We have to have that focus on what does it mean to do things actually in a more human way, so that we are asking the question and answering it, what do we want to use AI for? And that's what I would say is, like, we have this opportunity to do things that are actually more human. And that's why we should be applying AI, not for any really sexy stuff, but just to reduce the drudgery and the paperwork. It's a better calculator. It's a better word processor. And that's how we should be using it. But that means making sure, again, we're focused on where we want to go and what we're using it for.
Let's hear from a caller, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you want to call in. Let's hear from Robert. And Robert, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
My question is for her, and I'm just a little confused. I am one of the upper-tier Americans in America, elder. And so my question is going to be, is that China claims that no matter how much money it takes, they will dominate AI. And are the data centers that are being built all over the place feeding the AI systems that we know of as of today? And will that help us dominate AI other than letting China be the leader of AI? And for what reason? What is it for exactly? What is the big push in between China saying we're going to lead it and the U.S. saying, no, we're going to lead it?
All right, Robert, thank you for that. And so what do you think? I mean, can you answer Robert's question, Beth?
Sure. I think Robert is asking exactly the right question. What is AI for? And this, what you're hearing about at the national level, which is we cannot regulate AI because we have to beat China at AI. And he's asking the right question. Why is that the case?
I mean, didn't they tell us it was going to cure diseases and things like that and develop new materials? And what happened to all that?
So a lot of that is happening. Again, let's go back just one step to understand that at its most basic, AI is just software for recognizing patterns in data. So when you take 10,000 images of a cancerous tumor, the software is really, really good. You tell it, this is 10,000 images of a cancerous tumor, and then you give it image 10,001, and because it's really good at recognizing patterns, it can help you because it has much better visibility than me with my bad eyesight or, you know, my radiologist at saying, I think that might be a cancerous tumor. Or 10,000 pictures of wildfires, and you give it picture 10,001, and it says, it spots the wildfire before even sort of a human can spot it. So there are great uses around climate, around healthcare, and again, in lots of other arenas. So we do want to use these tools. We want to use them for these good purposes, like fighting climate change and dealing with diseases and helping kids to read better. So there's lots of good things we want to do. But I think the message about it is an all-out race with China, and therefore we can't regulate these tools. That is really, regulation actually is not the issue here. It is great that China is actually developing its own AI, because frankly, that race, and they are developing AI that is more energy efficient, more water efficient, more cost effective. I think that competition is actually great for the marketplace. But what they're doing differently than what we're doing is they're asking the question, how can we use these tools? How might I use them in my community to reduce traffic fatalities? How could I use it to help a teacher spend more time with kids by reducing the drudgery and paperwork? How can I use it to provide better information to people? That work, by the way, is happening all over the US now at the state level and at the local level. It's just, to Robert's point, not what you're hearing about out of Washington, where the discussion is only about China, 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 and no guardrails, no regulation, no safety. And I think, again, that is a really false dichotomy. We can both regulate these things and enjoy the economic benefits from them. And more importantly, have an answer to his question, what are we using it for? That's what we're missing, is that vision.
I've heard the phrase whole humans out of the loop, and why that is a bad thing. Well, if you want AI to give you the options, but you don't want AI to make the decisions. And that includes trying to improve democracy. Is that something that's being considered?
So obviously these tools are really good at automating things. I have an AI tool set up every day to tell me what are the emails that are waiting to which I owe a response. So it reads through my email and it summarizes for me, oh, all these people are waiting for an answer from you. What I don't have it do is write the replies to those emails. I use it to get information, but not to make decisions. Now, knowing how to use tools responsibly and effectively, it's not dissimilar to a car, right? We don't let you get behind the wheel, says the mother of a teenager, without driver's ed, without having a driver's license and knowing what the rules of the road are. That is why it's so important that we invest in education about how these tools work, how we want to use them, and how we don't want to use them. So yes, that over-reliance, that taking the human out of the loop, whether it's something that, again, AI does by itself or something we allow it to do, you know, is really dangerous. And I think the decisions about where those boundaries are, we're only going to make really effectively if we have control over these tools. Let me give you a quick example, though, just to give folks a little bit more hope, I hope. This is not something you have to wait, you know, on somebody else to do. We've been building a wonderful project together with a group called Innovate Public Schools called the AIEP Project. So for parents of children with an individualized education program, the document you get from government that says what services you're entitled to if you have a child with a disability or a learning need in the school system, we've been working with parents who are non-native English speakers, low literacy, to help design a tool to help them understand, summarize, translate that document and better advocate for their child. Those tools are built by those parents. And that's a great thing about these tools is they're driven by plain language, so anybody can work with them. You don't need a computer science degree. You don't need a PhD. The parents built the tools. They said, this is what we want. This is what makes for a good summary for us. This is what the information is that we're looking for. We're not looking for somebody to make a decision about our child, but we do want some information to empower us. I think we need more work like this that's really bottom-up and community-driven, but we should be investing in and, again, funding the widespread provisioning of AI education for communities, for schools, for governments.
What is the low-hanging fruit? What can a local government, like a city, like San Antonio, how can they use AI to improve government?
Oh, how long do we have?
You have a minute and a half.
It starts with saying, get rid of the legalese and the bureaucraties. Take everything that's now on the web and use AI to ask AI, put this at a ninth grade reading level, A. B, give this to me in the language of every person in our community. C, put a feedback button on every service that the city offers to the public now so the public can say, this is what's working and what's not working, and then use AI to summarize and analyze what people are telling you so you can go out and improve those services. It's the people who receive the services. You know, we know where the potholes are. We know where the wait times are at the DMV. Getting that information from people and actually using it, we can turn around now really fast and use that to improve how things work better than we've ever done before. It's really low-hanging fruit, and it's really simple, and it's not about AI on top. It's about AI on tap. Tools that we use, like a word processor, like a calculator, to make our work more efficient so we can spend more time doing the human things that we all want to do.
Beth Simon-Novak is the author of Reboot, AI, and the Race to Save Democracy. I'm really glad I talked to you about this. I'm really glad I got a chance to go over what you're talking about. Really interesting stuff, Beth. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and thanks to Robert for the great question.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.